two flower. The voice was hollow and echoing, and just recognisable as Rincewind's. Two flower stopped with his hand halfway to the book. Yes, he said. Is that you, Rincewind?
Yes, said the voice, resonant with the tones of the grave. And there is something very important I want you to do for me, Two Flower.
Two Flower looked around. He pulled himself together. So the fate of the disc would depend on him after all. I'm ready, he said, his voice vibrating with pride. What is it you want me to do?
First, I want you to listen very carefully, said Rincewind's disembodied voice patiently.
I'm listening.
It's very important that when I tell you what to do, you don't say, what do you mean, or argue, or anything. Understand?
Two Flower stood to attention. At least his mind stood to attention. His body really couldn't. He stuck out several of his chins.
I'm ready, he said. Good. Now, what I want you to do is...
Yes? Rincewind's voice rose from the depths of the stairwell.
I want you to come and help me up before I lose my grip on this stone, it said.
Two Flower opened his mouth, then shut it quickly. He ran to the square hole and peered down. By the ruddy light of the star, he could just make out Rincewind's eyes looking up at him. Two Flower lay down on his stomach and reached out. Rincewind's hand gripped his wrist in the sort of grip that told Two Flower that if he, Rincewind, wasn't pulled up, then there was no possible way in which that grip was going to be relaxed.
"I'm glad you're alive," he said.
"Good. So am I," said Rincewind.
He hung around in the darkness for a bit. After the past few minutes, it was almost enjoyable. But only almost.
"Pull me up, then," he hinted.
"I think that might be sort of difficult," grunted Two Flower. "I don't actually think I can do it, in fact."
"What are you holding on to, then?"
"You.
I mean, besides me."
"What do you mean, besides you?" said Two Flower. Rincewind said a word.
"Well, look," said Two Flower. "The steps go around in a spiral, right? If I sort of swing you and then let you go—"
"If you're going to suggest I try dropping 20 feet down a pitch-dark tower in the hope of hitting a couple of greasy little steps which might not even still be there, you can forget it," said Rincewind sharply.
"There is an alternative, then."
"Out with it, man."
"You could drop 500 feet down a pitch-black tower and hit stones which certainly are there," said Two Flower.
Dead silence came from below him. Then Rincewind said, accusingly, "That was sarcasm."
"I thought it was just stating the obvious," Rincewind grunted. "I suppose you couldn't do some magic," Two Flower began.
"No, just a thought."
There was a flare of light far below, and a confused shouting, and then more lights, more shouting, and a line of torches starting up the long spiral.
"There's some people coming up the stairs," said Two Flower, always keen to inform.
"I hope they're running," said Rincewind. "I can't feel my arm."
"You're lucky," said Two Flower. "I can feel mine."
The leading torch stopped its climb and a voice rang out, filling the hollow tower with indecipherable echoes.
"I think," said Two Flower, aware that he was gradually sliding further over the hole, "that was someone telling us to hold on."
Rincewind said another word, and then he said in a lower and more urgent tone,
"Actually, I don't think I can hang on any longer."
"Try."
"It's no good. I can feel my hand slipping."
Two Flower sighed. It was time for harsh measures.
"All right, then," he said. "Drop, then. See if I care."
"What?" said Rincewind, so astonished he forgot to let go.
"Go on, die. Take the easy way out."
"Easy? All you have to do is plummet screaming through the air and break every bone in your body," said Two Flower.
"Anybody can do it. Go on. I wouldn't want you to think that perhaps you ought to stay alive because we need you to say the spells and save the disc. Oh, no. Who cares if we all get burned up? Go on, just think of yourself. Drop."
There was a long, embarrassed silence. "I don't know why it is," said Rincewind, eventually, in a voice rather louder than necessary. "But ever since I met you, I seem to have spent a lot of time hanging by my fingers over certain depth. Have you noticed?"
"Death," corrected Two Flower.
"Death what?" said Rincewind.
"Certain death," said Two Flower, helpfully, trying to ignore the slow but inexorable slide of his body across the flagstones. "Hanging over certain death. You don't like heights."
"Heights I don't mind," said Rincewind's voice from the darkness. "Heights I can live with. It's depths that are occupying my attention at the moment. Do you know what I'm going to do when we get out of this?"
No, said Two Flower, wedging his toes into a gap in the flagstones and trying to make himself immobile by sheer force of will. I'm going to build a house in the flattest country I can find, and it's only going to have a ground floor, and I'm not even going to wear sandals with thick soles. The leading torch came around the last turn of the spiral, and Two Flower looked down on the grinning face of Cohen. Behind him, still hopping awkwardly up the stones, he could make out the reassuring bulk of the luggage.
"Everything all right?" said Cohen. "Can I do anything?"
Rincewind took a deep breath. Two Flower recognised the signs. Rincewind was about to say something like, "Yes, I've got this itch on the back of my neck. You couldn't scratch it, could you, on your way past?" Or, "No, I enjoy hanging over bottomless drops." And he decided he couldn't possibly face that. He spoke very quickly. "Pull Rincewind back onto the stairs," he snapped. Rincewind deflated in mid-snarl. Cohen caught him around the waist and jerked him unceremoniously onto the stones.
"Nasty mess down on the floor down there," he said, conversationally. "Who was it?"
"Did it," Rincewind swallowed, "did it have, you know, tentacles and things?"
"No," said Cohen, "just the normal bits. Spread out a bit, of course."
Rincewind looked at Two Flower, who shook his head. "Just a wizard who let things get on top of him," he said. Unsteadily, with his arms screaming at him, Rincewind let himself be helped back onto the roof of the tower. "How did you get here?" he added. Cohen pointed to the luggage, which had trotted over to Two Flower, and opened its lid like a dog that knows it's been bad and is hoping that a quick display of affection may avert the rolled-up newspaper of authority.
"Bumpy but fast," he said admiringly. "I'll tell you this, no one tries to stop you."
Rincewind looked up at the sky. It was indeed full of moons, huge cratered disks now 10 times bigger than the disk's tiny satellite. He looked at them without much interest. He felt washed out and stretched well beyond breaking point, as fragile as ancient elastic. He noticed that Two Flower was trying to set up his picture box. Cohen was looking at the 7 senior wizards.
"Funny place to put statues," he said. "No one can see them. Mind you, I can't say they're up to much. Very poor work."
Rincewind staggered across and tapped Wirt gingerly on the chest. He was solid stone. "This is it," he thought. "I just want to go home. Hang on, I am home, more or less. So I just want a good sleep, and perhaps it will all be better in the morning." His gaze fell on the octavo, which was outlined in tiny flashes of octarine fire. "Oh, yes," he thought. He picked it up and thumbed idly through its pages. They were thick with complex and swirling script that changed and reformed even as he looked at it. It seemed undecided as to what it should be. One moment it was an orderly, matter-of-fact printing, the next a series of angular runes. Then it would be a curly Kithian spell script. Then it would be pictograms in some ancient, evil and forgotten writing that seemed to consist exclusively of unpleasant reptilian beings doing complicated and painful things to one another. The last page was empty. Rincewind sighed and looked in the back of his mind. The spell looked back. He had dreamed of this moment, how he would finally evict the spell and take vacant possession of his own head and learn all those lesser spells which had up until then been too frightened to stay in his mind. Somehow he had expected it to be far more exciting. Instead, in utter exhaustion and in a mood to brook no argument, he stared coldly at the spell and jerked a metaphorical thumb over his shoulder. "You, out." It looked for a moment as though the spell was going to argue, but it wisely thought better of it. There was a tingling sensation, a blue flash behind his eyes, and a sudden feeling of emptiness. When he looked down at the page, it was full of words. They were runes again. He was glad about that. The reptilian pictures were not only unspeakable, but probably unpronounceable too, and reminded him of things he would have great difficulty in forgetting. He looked blankly at the book while Two Flower bustled around unheeded and Cohen tried in vain to lever the rings off the stone wizards. He had to do something, he reminded himself. What was it now? He opened the book at the first page and began to read, his lips moving and his forefinger tracing the outline of each letter. As he mumbled each word, it appeared soundlessly in the air beside him, in bright colours that streamed away in the night wind. He turned over the page. Other people were coming up the steps now, star people. Citizens, even some of the patrician's personal guard. A couple of star people made a half-hearted attempt to approach Rincewind, who was surrounded now by a rainbow swirl of letters and took absolutely no notice of them. But Cohen drew his sword and looked nonchalantly at them, and they thought better of it. Silence spread out from Rincewind's bent form like ripples in a puddle. It cascaded down the tower and spread out through the milling crowds below, flowed over the walls, gushed darkly through the city, and engulfed the lands beyond. The bulk of the star loomed silently over the disk. In the sky around it, the new moons turned slowly and noiselessly. The only sound was Rincewind's hoarse whispering as he turned page after page.
"Isn't this exciting?" said Twoflower.
Cohen, who was rolling a cigarette from the tarry remnants of its ancestors, looked at him blankly, paper halfway to his lips.
"Isn't what exciting?" he said. "All this magic." "Yes, only lights," said Cohen critically. "He hasn't even produced doves out of his sleeves." "Yes, but can't you sense the occult potentiality?" said Twoflower.
Cohen produced a big yellow match from somewhere in his tobacco bag, looked at Wirt for a moment, and with great deliberation struck the match on his fossilized nose.
"Look," he said to Twoflower, as kindly as he could manage, "what do you expect? I've been around a long time, I've seen the whole magical thing, and I can tell you that if you go round with your jaw dropping all the time, people hit it. Anyway, wizards die just like anyone else when you stick a..."
There was a loud snap as Rincewind shut the book. He stood up and looked around. What happened next was this. Nothing. It took a little while for people to realize it. Everyone had ducked instinctively, waiting for the explosion of white light or scintillating fireball, or in the case of Cohen, who had fairly low expectations, a few white pigeons, possibly a slightly crumpled rabbit. It wasn't even an interesting nothing. Sometimes things can fail to happen in quite impressive ways, but as far as non-events went, this one just couldn't compete.
"Is that it?" said Cohen.
There was a general muttering from the crowd, and several of the star people were looking angrily at Rincewind. The wizard stared blearily at Cohen.
"I suppose so," he said.
"But nothing's happened."
Rincewind looked blankly at the Octavo.
"Maybe it has a subtle effect," he said hopefully. "After all, we don't know exactly what is supposed to happen."
"We knew it!" shouted one of the star people. "Magic don't work! It's an illusion!"
A stone looped over the roof and hit Rincewind on the shoulder.
"Yeah," said another star person. "Let's get him. Let's throw him off the tower." "Yeah, let's get him and throw him off the tower."
The crowd surged forward. Twoflower held up his hands.
"I'm sure there's just been a slight mistake," he began, before his legs were kicked from underneath him. "Oh, bugger," said Cohen, dropping his dog end and grinding it under a sandaled foot.
He drew his sword and looked around for the luggage. It hadn't rushed to Twoflower's aid. It was standing in front of Rincewind, who was clutching the Octavo to his chest like a hot water bottle and looking frantic. A star man lunged at him. The luggage raised its lid threateningly.
"I know why it hasn't worked," said a voice from the back of the crowd.
It was Bethan.
"Oh, yeah," said the nearest citizen. "And why should we listen to you?"
A mere fraction of a second later, Cohen's sword was pressed against his neck.
"On the other hand," said the man evenly, "perhaps we should pay attention to what this young lady has got to say."
As Cohen swung around slowly with his sword at the ready, Bethan stepped forward and pointed to the swirling shapes of the spells, which still hung in the air around Rincewind.
"That one can't be right," she said, indicating a smudge of dirty brown amidst the pulsing, brightly coloured flares. "You must have mispronounced a word. Let's have a look."
Rincewind passed her the Octavo without a word. She opened it and peered at the pages.
"What funny writing," she said. "It keeps changing. What's that crocodile thing doing to the octopus?"
Rincewind looked over her shoulder and, without thinking, told her. She was silent for a moment.
"Oh," she said levelly, "I didn't know crocodiles could do that."
"It's just ancient picture writing," said Rincewind hurriedly. "It'll change if you wait. The spells can appear in every known language."
"Can you remember what you said when the wrong colour appeared?"
Rincewind ran a finger down the page. "There, I think, where the two-headed lizard is doing... whatever it's doing." Twoflower appeared at her other shoulder. The spell flowed into another script.
"I can't even pronounce it," said Bethan. "Squiggle, squiggle, dot, dash."
"That's Cup o' Muggock, snow runes," said Rincewind. "I think it should be pronounced zf."
"It didn't work, though. How about sf?"
They looked at the word. It remained resolutely off colour. "Or sf," said Bethan.
"It might be tsf,"
said Rincewind doubtfully.
If anything, the colour became a dirtier shade of brown.
"How about zzz?" said Two Flower.
"Don't be silly," said Rincewind. "With snow runes, the..." Bethan elbowed him in the stomach and pointed. The brown shape in the air was now a brilliant red. The book trembled in her hands. Rincewind grabbed her around the waist, snatched Two Flower by the collar, and jumped backwards. Bethan lost her grip on the octavo, which tumbled towards the floor, and didn't reach it. The air around the octavo glowed. It rose slowly, flapping its pages like wings. Then there was a plangent, sweet, twanging noise, and it seemed to explode in a complicated silent flower of light, which rushed outwards, faded, and was gone. But something was happening much further up in the sky. Down in the geological depths of Great Artuin's huge brain, new thoughts surged along neural pathways the size of arterial roads. It was impossible for a sky turtle to change its expression, but in some indefinable way its scaly, meteor-pocked face looked quite expectant. It was staring fixedly at the eight spheres endlessly orbiting around the star on the very beaches of space. The spheres were cracking. Huge segments of rock broke away and began the long spiral down to the star. The sky filled with glittering shards. From the wreckage of one hollow shell, a very small sky turtle paddled its way into the red light. It was barely bigger than an asteroid, its shell still shiny with molten yolk. There were four small world elephant calves on there, too. And on their backs was a discworld, tiny as yet, covered in smoke and volcanoes. Great Artuin waited until all eight baby turtles had freed themselves from their shells and were treading space and looking bewildered. Then, carefully, so as not to dislodge anything, the old turtle turned and, with considerable relief, set out on the long swim to the blessedly cool, bottomless depths of space. The young turtles followed, orbiting their parent. Two Flower stared raptly at the display overhead. He had probably had the best view of anyone on the disk. Then a terrible thought occurred to him.
"Where's the picture box?"
he asked urgently.
"What?"
said Rincewind, eyes fixed on the sky.
"The picture box," said Two Flower. "I must get a picture of this."
"Can't you just remember it?" said Bethan, not looking at him.
"I might forget." "I won't ever forget," she said. "It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen."
"Much better than pigeons and billiard balls," agreed Cohen. "I'll give you that, Rincewind. How's it done?"
"I don't know," said Rincewind.
"The star's getting smaller," said Bethan.
Rincewind was vaguely aware of Two Flower's voice arguing with the demon who lived in the box and painted the pictures. It was quite a technical argument about field depths and whether or not the demon still had enough red paint. It should be pointed out that currently Great Artuin was very pleased and contented, and feelings like that in a brain the size of several large cities are bound to radiate out. In fact, most people on the disk were currently in a state of mind normally achievable only by a lifetime of dedicated meditation or about 30 seconds of illegal herbage. "That's old Two Flower," Rincewind thought. "It's not that he doesn't appreciate beauty, he just appreciates it in his own way. I mean, if a poet sees a daffodil, he stares at it and writes a long poem about it. But Two Flower wanders off to find a book on botany, and treads on it. It's right what Cohen said. He just looks at things, but nothing he looks at is ever the same again. Including me, I suspect." The disk's own sun rose. The star was already dwindling, and it wasn't quite so much competition. Good, reliable disk light poured across the enraptured landscape like a sea of gold. Or, as the more reliable observers generally held, like golden syrup. That is a nice dramatic ending. But life doesn't work like that, and there were other things that had to happen. There was the octavo, for example. As the sunlight hit it, the book snapped shut and started to fall back to the tower, and many of the observers realized that dropping towards them was the single most magical thing on the Discworld. The feeling of bliss and brotherhood evaporated, along with the morning dew. Rincewind and Two Flower were elbowed aside as the crowd surged forward, struggling and trying to climb up one another, hands outstretched. The octavo dropped into the centre of the shouting mass. There was a snap, a decisive snap, the sort of snap made by a lid that doesn't intend to be opening in a hurry. Rincewind peered between someone's legs at Two Flower. "Do you know what I think's going to happen?" he said, grinning.
"What?"
"I think that when you open the luggage, there's just going to be your laundry in there. That's what I think."
"Oh, dear.
I think the Octavo knows how to look after itself. Best place for it, really."
"I suppose so. You know, sometimes I get the feeling that the luggage knows exactly what it's doing."
"I know what you mean."
They crawled to the edge of the milling crowd, stood up, dusted themselves off, and headed for the steps. No one paid them any attention.
"What are they doing now?" said Two Flower, trying to see over the heads of the throng.
"It looks as though they're trying to lever it open," said Rincewind.
There was a snap and a scream. "I think the luggage rather enjoys the attention," said Two Flower, as they began their cautious descent.
"Yes, it probably does it good to get out and meet people," said Rincewind. "And now I think it'd do me good to go and order a couple of drinks."
"Good idea," said Two Flower. "I'll have a couple of drinks too."
It was nearly noon when Two Flower awoke. He couldn't remember why he was in a hayloft, or why he was wearing someone else's coat, but he did wake up with one idea right at the forefront of his mind. He decided it was vitally important to tell Rincewind about it. He fell out of the hay and landed on the luggage.
"Oh, you're here, are you?" he said. "I hope you're ashamed of yourself."
The luggage looked bewildered.
"Anyway, I want to comb my hair. Open up," said Two Flower.
The luggage obligingly flipped its lid. Two Flower rooted around among the bags and boxes inside until he found a comb and a mirror and repaired some of the damage of the night. Then he looked hard at the luggage.
"I suppose you wouldn't like to tell me what you've done with the Octavo?"
The luggage's expression could only be described as wooden.
"All right, come on then."
Two Flower stepped out into the sunlight, which was slightly too bright for his current tastes, and wandered aimlessly along the street. Everything seemed fresh and new, even the smells, but there didn't seem to be many people up yet. It had been a long night. He found Rincewind at the foot of the Tower of Art, supervising a team of workmen who'd rigged up a gantry of sorts on the roof and were lowering the stone wizards to the ground. He seemed to be assisted by a monkey, but Two Flower was in no mood to be surprised at anything.
"Will they be able to be turned back?" he said.
Rincewind looked around.
"What? Oh, it's you. No, probably not. I'm afraid they dropped poor old Wirt anyway, 500 feet onto cobbles."
"Will you be able to do anything about that?"
"Make a nice rockery."
Rincewind turned and waved at the workman.
"You're very cheerful," said Two Flower, a shade reproachfully. "Didn't you go to bed?"
"Funny thing, I couldn't sleep," said Rincewind. "I came out for a breath of fresh air, and no one seemed to have any idea what to do, so I just sort of got people together."
He indicated the librarian, who tried to hold his hand, and started organising things.
"Nice day, isn't it? Air like wine."
"Rincewind, I've decided that—"
"You know, I think I might re-enroll," said Rincewind cheerfully. "I think I could really make a go of things this time. I can really see myself getting to grips with magic and graduating really well. They do say if it's a summer cum laude, then the living is easy."
"Good, because there's plenty of room at the top, too. Now all the big boys will be doing doorstep duty, and—"
"I'm going home.
A sharp lad with a bit of experience of the world could—"
"What?"
"Hmm?"
"I said, I'm going home," repeated Two Flower, making polite little attempts to shake off the librarian, who was trying to pick lice off him.
"What home?" said Rincewind, astonished.
"Home, home. My home, where I live,"
Two Flower explained sheepishly.
"Back across the sea. You know, where I came from. Will you please stop doing that?"
"Oh.
Hmm?"
There was a pause. Then Two Flower said,
"You see, last night it occurred to me. I thought, well, the thing is, all this travelling and seeing things is fine, but there's also a lot of fun to be had from having been. You know, sticking all your pictures in a book and remembering things."
"There is?"
"Hmm?" "Oh, yes. The important thing about having lots of things to remember is that you've got to go somewhere afterwards where you can remember them, you see. You've got to stop. You haven't really been anywhere until you've got back home. I think that's what I mean."
Rincewind ran the sentence across his mind again. It didn't seem any better second time round.
"Oh," he said again. "Well, good, if that's the way you look at it. When are you going, then?"
"Today, I think. There's bound to be a ship going part of the way."
"I expect so," said Rincewind awkwardly.
He looked at his feet. He looked at the sky. He cleared his throat.
"We've been through some times together, eh?" said Two Flower, nudging him in the ribs.
"Yeah," said Rincewind, contorting his face into something like a grin.
You're not upset, are you?
Who, me? Said Rincewind. Gosh, no. 101 things to do.
That's all right, then. Listen, let's go and have breakfast, and then we can go down to the docks.
Rincewind nodded dismally, turned to his assistant, and took a banana out of his pocket.
You've got the hang of it now. You take over, he muttered.
Mmm.
In fact, there wasn't any ship going anywhere near the Agatian Empire. But that was an academic point, because Twoflower simply counted gold pieces into the hand of the first captain with a halfway clean ship, until the man suddenly saw the merits of changing his plans. Rincewind waited on the quayside until Twoflower had finished paying the man about 40 times more than his ship was worth.
"That's settled, then," said Twoflower. "He'll drop me at the Brown Islands, and I can easily get a ship from there."
"Great," said Rincewind.
Twoflower looked thoughtful for a moment, then he opened the luggage and pulled out a bag of gold.
"Have you seen Cohen and Bethan?" he said.
"I think they went off to get married," said Rincewind. "I heard Bethan say it was now or never."
"Well, when you see them, give them this," said Twoflower, handing him the bag. "I know it's expensive setting up home for the first time."
Twoflower had never fully understood the gulf in the exchange rate. The bag could quite easily set Cohen up with a small kingdom.
"I'll hand it over first chance I get," he said, and to his own surprise realized that he meant it.
"Good. I've thought about something to give you, too."
"Oh, there's no..."
Twoflower rummaged in the luggage and produced a large sack. He began to fill it with clothes and money and the picture box, until finally the luggage was completely empty. The last thing he put in it was his souvenir musical cigarette box with the shell-encrusted lid, carefully wrapped in soft paper.
"It's all yours,"
he said, shutting the luggage's lid. "I shan't really need it any more, and it won't fit in my wardrobe anyway."
"What?
Don't you want it?"
"Well, I... of course, but it's yours. It follows you, not me."
"Luggage," said Twoflower, "this is Rincewind. You're his, right?"
The luggage slowly extended its legs, turned very deliberately and looked at Rincewind.
"I don't think it belongs to anyone but itself, really," said Twoflower.
"Yes," said Rincewind uncertainly.
"Well, that's about it, then," said Twoflower. He held out his hand. "Goodbye, Rincewind. I'll send you a postcard when I get home, or something."
"Yes. Any time you're passing, there's bound to be someone here who knows where I am."
"Yes. Well, that's it, then."
"That's it, right enough."
"Right."
"Yep."
Twoflower walked up the gangplank, which the impatient crew hauled up behind him. The rowing drum started its beat, and the ship was propelled slowly out onto the turbid waters of the Ankh, now back to their old level, where it caught the tide and turned towards the open sea. Rincewind watched it until it was a dot. Then he looked down at the luggage. It stared back at him.
"Look," he said, "go away. I'm giving you to yourself, do you understand?"
He turned his back on it and stalked away. After a few seconds, he was aware of the little footsteps behind him. He spun round.
"I said I don't want you," he snapped, and gave it a kick.
The luggage sagged. Rincewind stalked away. After he had gone a few yards, he stopped and listened. There was no sound. When he turned, the luggage was where he had left it. It looked sort of huddled. Rincewind thought for a while.
"All right, then," he said. "Come on."
He turned his back and strode off to the university. After a few minutes, the luggage appeared to make up its mind, extended its legs again, and padded after him. It didn't see that it had a lot of choice. They headed along the quay and into the city, two dots on a dwindling landscape, which, as the perspective broadened, included a tiny ship starting out across a wide green sea that was but a part of a bright circling ocean on a cloud-swirled disk on the back of four giant elephants that themselves stood on the shell of an enormous turtle, which soon became a glint among the stars and disappeared.
That is the end of The Light Fantastic by Terry Pratchett, and it was read by Nigel Planer.